Let's take some phone calls, and our number is 212-267-WNYC, and again, anyone can call, but a special invitation this morning to some of our African-American listeners to talk about the difference in your own mind between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and the legacies of the two here in this 25th anniversary year, unfortunately, after the assassination of Martin Luther King. It was 1968, and that makes it 25 years ago this year. Let's go first to line three. I see actually that we have a very special caller. Arthur Ashe is calling us up this morning. Good morning, Mr. Ashe.
Morning.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I thought the show was very interesting, and listening to the tapes, I heard one segment from Dr. King, which is dear to my heart, and that is the one that says, let's not satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness. I remember that and know it by heart already, and certainly it was something that I try to live by.
And how does the legacy of Malcolm X sit with you?
Well, I was at UCLA, and you heard Dr. Cohen talking about the Watts riot. I was at UCLA, a student there, started in 61, graduated in 66. So I was very, very aware of the buildup to the Watts riots in 66, and I'm not at all surprised that we had another revolt last spring. But we talked about Malcolm, when I say we, I'm talking about the African-American contingent there, as well as some of the African students, because UCLA always had a very strong African presence. We talked about Malcolm a lot, I would say just about every day. And I agree with Professor Cohen that it was done in the context of the times, because the Anglophone and Francophone colonies in Africa were in the process of being granted or winning their independence. And we certainly make comparisons or analogs between their experience and what was going on with us. I am a Southerner, born, bred in Virginia under segregation. I certainly understood it. But as a Southerner, listening to Malcolm X, I was really turned off by him at first. I thought he was actually frightening. I remember talking about it at school, but basically what scared me about him was that I thought he was difficult to morally defend, very difficult to morally defend. He called white people devils and sort of broad-brushed all of them, and what capped it for me later in his life, unfortunately, is that he went to Mecca, came back, told all of us about this conversion, and my reaction to it was, Malcolm, I'd never met the man, but Malcolm, I could have told you that before you went. I myself knew a lot of blonde, blue-eyed Muslims, so I thought he was quite naive in just finding out after his trip to Mecca that there were other Muslims around the world of different hues and shades. But basically, being a Southerner, and I suspect that that has a lot to do with it, I thought the principles that I grew up in the black church and had a very ecumenical look on life. Martin Luther King was more to my liking, but as a young college student, very aware of the inequities in our society, Malcolm certainly spoke and vocalized the rage that I felt about this injustice.
Yeah, I think what Arthur Ashe has said expressed the sentiment of myself at that time in the early 1960s. I certainly did not respond to Malcolm X. I responded to Martin King because I, too, came from the South, and I understood what it meant to live in segregation context, and therefore Martin King articulated a resistance to that that captured my imagination and the imagination of most people. But what is interesting is that by the end of the 1960s, is that Malcolm's emphasis on the need to affirm one's identity with Africa and one's blackness, that began to emerge within the context of my consciousness and the consciousness of many African Americans in a way that it did not in the 1960s, early part of the 1960s. So some I tend to see when I look at that period is that the first half of the 1960s certainly belonged to Martin King. But the second half of the 1960s, with the rise of black power and the rise of black consciousness, that was Malcolm's impact, even though Malcolm was off the scene at that time.
Arthur Ashe, what's your reaction to the pop culture aspects of Malcolm X today? You probably see young kids wearing Malcolm X caps and Malcolm X sweatbands on the tennis courts and whatnot.
That's right. I understand it, and we are a faddish people as far as our youngsters are concerned, and I understand that. And I think because for a large segment of the African-American population, the growing underclass that William Julius Wilson talks about so much, nothing has changed so much. In fact, I'm sure Professor Cohen would say that things have actually gotten worse for them as people like myself who are educated and could take advantage of these new openings that popped up as a result of the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act. As we took advantage of these opportunities, we moved away from traditional neighborhoods where we all lived in the same place, and we left this underclass by themselves. Now, they just sort of festered. They were leaderless, no role models, no people to really look out for them. And as a result, they are still now looking for another Malcolm to come in and vocalize their concerns. But one other point I wanted to make, and I know you got to go to some other callers.
Mm-hmm.
One of my biggest disappointments is that the black political movement, in a broad way, has lost its moral underpinning. I thought at the very beginning of the 60s, not just because of Dr. King, we had the moral high ground. We could look anyone in the eye and say, what we are trying to do, what we are trying to accomplish is right, it's just, it's long overdue, and there's no excuse for not helping us to achieve it. But someplace in the late 60s and early 70s, it became strictly political. The moral underpinnings, as far as I'm concerned, were sort of wiped away. Machiavellian almost.
Mm.
And so now it's very difficult for these. I'll just give you one last example. I was watching the revolt from L.A. last spring. On CNN in the middle of the day, they had one Crip and one Blood, the two gangs out there. And they were talking about their reaction to Reginald Denny, the white truck driver, being pulled out of his truck and beaten nearly half to death. And some call-in, like this show, so what's your reaction to that? And they both said, it doesn't mean anything to me. My reaction was, as I said to my wife, that's not us. That is not us. And if that had happened in the mid-60s even, the reaction would not have been like that. And so I just think that somehow we have to regain the moral underpinning for whatever we would like to do politically and philosophically.
How do you think?
I don't know, because obviously the influence of the black church has diminished greatly. And as Malcolm himself mentioned, he is the creature of the northern urban experience. He had very little experience, firsthand or otherwise, with southern living. And he also spoke to those people, black people, in the north. I suspect if Malcolm had come south with some of those same things, they would have turned him away. I mean, I just really believe that. I mean, you would have had a contingent of young, angry people who would have listened. But even if he had gone to some of the black colleges in the South with some of that, first of all, I am convinced the administrators at some of these black Southern schools wouldn't have wanted Malcolm to come and talk like that in the 60s. But Malcolm, I just thought, as much as I was, arrested and attracted to his rhetoric, really, I thought, was a bit more a creature, not a creature, maybe the wrong choice of words, but a product of a northern urban experience. Even though, as Dr. Cohen said, he tried to look at things internationally. But again, I really thought he was just naive when he said, came back from Mecca and said, I'm changed. And my reaction then was, Malcolm, I could have told you that before you left.
Yes, I agree much of what Arthur Ashe has said, but I do think it's important to see both Martin King and Malcolm X as moral forces, but they were more forces in different contexts. I think the power of King's message was suddenly grounded in the black church and in the South. And that's the context in which he carried out his moral force, as it were. The context of Malcolm X, of course, is in the North, as Arthur Ashe has said, but he also was a moral force, but primarily a moral force in the African-American community and helping African-Americans realize that their respect for themselves is as important as it is to respect whites, which King emphasized. So you have two different forces at work. There's no need to choose between them. We must see them in relation to each other.
Well, let me make one other comment. It's obviously an example I'm very, very familiar with. Malcolm X met a young boxer named Cassius Clay in the early 60s. And Cassius Clay, like me, was brought up in the South, Louisville, Kentucky, middle-class home, both mother and father present. He made a conversion to Islam, and then after he did that, we know in 67 he refused induction to the U.S. Army and his athletic career suffered. The point I'm just going to make here is that Cassius Clay, I don't think, would not have done that. Muhammad Ali did it. And I think that's an example of the sort of backbone that someone like Malcolm X instilled in some people like Cassius Clay to enable them to give them the nerve, the daring, the audacity to take that extra step, which some people thought would not be taken had they been led strictly by Martin Luther King.
Arthur Ashe, eloquent as always, and thanks a lot for giving us a little treat here by calling up. Thank you.
Thank you. I can turn my radio back on.
You may. You have our permission. Thank you very much.